kept, each one that time forgets. Flocks gather across the land, taking refuge in your hands.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Ohio Mysteries. The song you're listening to is No New Wilderness by Drew Joseph, folk singer-songwriter from Toledo, Ohio. Drew is our featured musical artist this week, and if you hang around with us to the end of the podcast, we'll tell you a little bit more about him, how to find his music, and play the whole song for you. But for now, let's throw another log on that fire, campers. Tonight, we've got one of Ohio's most famous mysteries. I'm your co-host, Steve Yoder. And with me is our researcher and storyteller, Paula Schleiss, an award-winning journalist who spent 30 years telling these kinds of stories for the Akron Beacon Journal.
Hi, everyone.
Paula, I know the topic tonight, and I gotta say, this is a murder that affected me most as a child. Amy Mihaljevic was about my age when she was kidnapped and murdered, and in some ways, it was an end to the childhood innocence for me. She was abducted on my birthday in 1989.
Oh, that was your birthday.
Yes.
Oh, Steve, you know, I've heard that from other people in your generation. It was a defining event for many people. And, you know, for me, what really affected me was how the killer played on her love for her mother to commit this terrible crime.
Absolutely. And we got a very special armchair detective with us this episode. Investigative reporter James Renner covered this case, wrote a book about it, and even pursued a suspect to Florida Keys to get answers to some of his questions. I can't wait to hear what he has to say. But first, why don't you lay out the basics of the story for us?
You got it. Well, our story begins in October of 1989, and Amy Renee Mihaljevic is living the life of a typical 10-year-old. She lives in the upscale Cleveland suburb of Bay Village with her mom, Margaret, her dad, Mark, and her brother, Jason. Now, it's worth saying that Bay Village is about as safe as it comes. There wasn't a single murder, abduction, or reported rape all of the prior year. You know, the kinds of lists that this community shows up on are more the type of safest and best communities to raise a child. And Amy is in the safest place of all in this safe village. She's at home. And that's when the phone rings. It's a man, and he identifies himself as a coworker of her mother's. Amy's mom, Margaret, worked at Trading Times magazine, and the man says she's going to be receiving a promotion. He tells Amy he needs help picking out a gift for her to celebrate. They have $45 to spend, and if they don't spend it at all, Amy can use what's left to pick out a little something for herself. Now, Amy's mother recently went from part-time to full-time, so Amy knew there was some kind of change happening. Perhaps that's why there was this comfort zone. Maybe that's why the call didn't seem to be so far-fetched. So on October 27, the day at Bay Middle School has come to an end. On this day, Amy and her fellow fifth-grade students actually sat through a presentation on stranger danger. That was a term very popular in those days as a way to warn kids against potential perils away from home.
Yeah, I remember those.
But Amy must not have thought of her mom's self-described coworker as a stranger, because even after that presentation, at 2:05 p.m., Amy is going to keep this appointment. Now, it's a Friday, a blue sky kind of day. Amy's day always ends about an hour before her brother Jason's. Her routine is to go home and call her mom at work to let her know all is well. But on this day, she and two friends walk a half mile to the Bay Village Square Shopping Center. And the friends leave her at Baskin-Robbins, where a man, perhaps 20 to 30 years old, wearing khakis, a polo shirt, and a members-only style jacket, approaches her and puts a hand on her shoulder. She willingly follows him through the parking lot, and they disappear. Huh. Now Jason finishes his school day and he goes home, only to find Amy isn't there. He calls their mother to mention it to her, and Margaret remembers Amy was thinking about trying out for choir, so maybe that's delayed her. So she tells Jason, wait a while and just call when Amy makes it home. Well, Margaret gets another phone call, but it's not Jason. It's Amy, but it's an odd call. The usual chatty Amy is only giving her mom one-word answers. It's so strange that Margaret is unnerved. She finishes her work quickly and heads home, arriving around 5 p.m., but Amy's not there. Margaret jumps back in the car and drives to Bay Middle School, and that's where she sees Amy's bike still resting in the rack, the only bike there. Now Margaret calls the police, and they react quickly. Amy's disappearance is on the 10 o'clock news that very night. And that's where a friend of Amy's sees the story and calls police to tell them how Amy had spoken of this man who wanted Amy's help picking out a present. Others who had seen Amy at the plaza, they describe this man to a police sketch artist, and a sketch is created and circulated all over. I will point out that police have all, even though they have the sketch, they have always pointed out that it was given by a couple of 10-year-olds. They don't want people to rely on it. They say, if you've got a suspect in mind that doesn't look like this, please don't think that this sketch is that accurate. Now, the Bay Village and police and the FBI, they launch a search that sometimes is described as the biggest search Ohio had seen in decades. There were thousands of leads. Authorities did some 20,000 interviews. Dozens of people submitted to lie detector tests. But the weeks pass, and they have no suspects and no Amy. 3 months later, on February 8, 1990, a jogger in rural Ashland County, that's about an hour's drive from Bay Village, spots something strange lying in a field along County Road 1181 in Ruggles Township. It's Amy. She's still wearing the clothes she was last seen in. It's clear to investigators that she had been dumped there shortly after her abduction. Even though she's far from home, investigators are going to come to believe her killer likely knew this area of Ashland, perhaps even killed her nearby. They find some other things at the scene that might prove helpful. On her body are yellow fibers, and about 300 feet from her is a green blanket and a curtain. These, of course, are odd things to be laying in a rural field. The olive green curtain appears to be handmade from a duvet cover or a bedspread, and on it are dog hairs, similar to that of a dog owned by the Mihalovics. So now it seems likely that these objects were used to conceal Amy's body before she was dumped in the field.
Right.
The Cuyahoga County coroner finds Amy's last meal was some sort of soy substance, perhaps Chinese food. There was some blood indicating a sexual assault, and the killer left something else behind, mitochondrial DNA. Now, that's not enough for a complete DNA profile, not the kind of thing you can run through a national DNA database. But there's enough there that could help point authorities in the right direction if they get the right suspect. Also interesting is what authorities don't find at the scene. Missing is one of Amy's turquoise horse earrings, her black ankle boots, a denim backpack, and a black leather binder with the words Buick, best in class, written on the front clasp. These things are believed to have been with Amy when she was taken, and it's possible some of these things were kept by the killer as a souvenir. Now, years after Amy's remains were recovered, we learned this might not have been the only girl that this killer had targeted. In 2006, this is 16 years after her death, police finally reveal there had been several other young girls who had received phone calls similar to the one Amy had received. Always a male caller, always using the ploy of wanting to get a present to celebrate the girl's mother. These other girls, none of them who had followed up with a caller, were living in North Olmsted. That's a community not far from Bay Village. and some of them had unlisted phone numbers. That was a vital piece of information, and trying to learn who might have placed those phone calls, who would have access to unlisted phone numbers. Well, through the course of their investigation, detectives learned the one thing all the girls had in common was they had all visited the local Lake Erie Nature and Science Center. And there, the center had a visitor's logbook, the kind of thing where you jot your name in at the front door. Could these girls also have innocently jotted down their phone numbers and addresses? And if so, does this mean the killer was tied to this center? Unfortunately, the logbook has disappeared. Those questions can't be answered. Steve, there is so, so much more about this case. It's been the subject of TV shows, blogs, websites, books, podcasts, and they've covered it far more extensively than this single podcast could ever cover. So let's stop there and head right over to our special guest, James Renner, who can help us focus on the most important insights into this case.
Sure, yes. James is a true crime author and one of my favorites, by the way. Actually, he is my favorite. I love his books. They're fantastic.
You have mentioned him many times to me.
Absolutely.
I know you're a fan.
His first book was about his own research into this case, the Amy Mihaljevic case.
Yeah.
So, welcome, James.
With us tonight is James Renner. He's an investigative journalist who has written several books. He hosts the podcast, The Philosophy of Crime. I hear, James, you've got a second season that's going to be dropping maybe in April?
Yes, sometime in the next few weeks. Yeah, hopefully sometime around end of March, early April, we'll come out with the second season.
Oh, we are very much looking forward to that. And among your nonfiction books, you did Amy, My Search for Her Killer. You have been on this case for, what, a couple of decades, right?
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, we were both born in 1978. And, you know, so this happened in 89, and I had just turned 11. And I've really been thinking about this case since then. I used to get on my Huffy two-speed, and when I'd live up with my mother in Rocky River, I'd jet on that bike over to Westgate Mall to see if I could find Amy in the crowds and or the guy that took her, you know, based on the composite sketch. So even back then, for, you know, I think it was just realizing that we lived in this world. And, you know, it was that moment that I realized that we live in this kind of dangerous world, and I wanted to do something about it. It just kind of stuck with me. It became the first big story that I wrote for Scene when I worked for Scene magazine, and then it was too much for an article, so it became my first book that came out in 2006.
You know, there's so much to this case that we can't possibly cover, you know, in the space of our little podcast. But I know you've got a primary suspect that you have zeroed in on. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because we haven't introduced our listeners to that at all.
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons, maybe the biggest reason this case has never been solved is there were too many men that had the means, motive, and opportunity to commit the crime. And the list of suspects has just been overwhelming for police and FBI. And the best the FBI has ever been able to do is narrow that list down to a top 25. And, you know, so I remember finding that out when I was a reporter, and you know, I'm just like, well, you know, where do I start? You know, how do I look into this? And it's daunting. And you look at each of these people, and they're very strange in their own way. And some of them definitely and admittedly paid attention to little Amy. And so she was just surrounded. And I don't know if it's, you know, the big question is something about this girl? Was it something about this crime? Or are there just, are we all surrounded by so many creeps at any time? I don't know which answer is barrier, but what I've hopefully done during my research into the case is narrow that list down to like a top three. I have three people in mind that are pretty good suspects, and then one absolutely rises over and above the others for good reason. You know, but how did I get to these three? You know, I think the key to solving Amy's case is figuring out how she was connected to these handful of girls in North Olmsted who also were called by her killer. This is a detail that isn't talked about as much as it probably should be in the news and news reports. They found out, and one of the reasons why this hasn't been talked about so much is the police kind of kept the secret for like 16 years for who knows whatever reason, because it would have been very helpful to know back in the day. But Amy, the way that her killer got to her was he called her at home when she was home alone after school in the days leading up to her abduction and said, "Hey, I work with your mother. She just got a promotion. Why don't you meet me at the Bay Square shopping plaza and I'll take you to get a present for her. It'll be a little surprise and it'll be nice for her." So that, of course, was a lie. You know, he didn't work with her mother. But it was a very specific kind of ruse. And before he called Amy, we now know that this person called a number of girls from the North Olmsted area. And so whoever it was had to know these girls from North Olmsted, which is the suburb south of Bay Village, and also Amy from Bay Village. So you look and try to find how these girls are connected, because in, you know, wherever they cross paths, somewhere in there is the killer. You know, it's like a big spider web, and he's right in the middle. So all three of my top suspects were connected to Amy and these other girls from North Olmsted. One of the ways in which they were connected is, and this came out only because of the book that I wrote, Amy had a horseback riding instructor with a very unique last name. And a couple of these girls from North Olmsted contacted me after the book came out and said, "Hey, that last name's really familiar to me. I had a math teacher with that same last name. I wonder if he is related to Amy's writing instructor." And I looked into it, and sure enough, this man was the writing instructor's brother. So that's a very weird connection. And so he's in my top three because of that. But he doesn't have any history of violence or anything like that, as far as we know. He doesn't have any criminal history. He's a weird dude, but that's about it.
Right.
The other way in which these girls were connected is they all visited the Lake Erie Nature and Science Center in the weeks leading up to Amy's abduction. And that's a little nature center up in Bay. And at the time, they had this log book where the kids would come in and they would sign their name and address and phone number. And then the center would take that information and put them on a mailing list. And you know, so that's how they sent out, you know, coupons or just notices for what the Nature Center was doing. So they all visited this place. And my number two suspect was the guy that was in charge of the Metro Parks at the time. And he would have had access because the Nature Center is in the Metro Parks, but it's technically a private company in this public land. So he would have been coming and going at that place. And he checked himself into a mental hospital 10 days after Amy was abducted. He has similar, he has some weird things in his past where he had to leave, I think, the state of Indiana after some allegations came up there before he came to the Cleveland area. Very strange guy, definitely a dangerous guy. Also, my top suspect is also connected to the Nature Center. And this is a guy who was a former teacher at Amherst and Vermilion School Districts. He used to bring mice to the Nature Center to feed to the snakes. He in his classroom in Amherst, he taught middle school science. He had this kind of like a personal zoo with, you know, mice and lizards and chinchillas and fish and who knows what. But when the mice bred and there'd be too many mice, he would take the mice over to the Nature Center so they could keep the snakes. So yeah, those are my top three suspects, and the top one too. We could go through just a list of reasons why he looks guilty. You know, he had a number of relationships with prepubescent students that he was caught in. When they asked him to, he was 29 years into a 30-year teaching career when the laws in the state of Ohio changed, and for the first time in his career, he had to get fingerprinted. He had never been fingerprinted because he had kind of come in through like a substitute teaching application in like 1972. So he was kind of grandfathered in, but they came to him and they're like, hey, we need your fingerprints. And he refused. He's like, no, I'm not going to give you my fingerprints. And he abruptly quit teaching 1 year from retirement. And that was around the time that the FBI were finally looking into him as a suspect in 2005. And he abruptly quit teaching and disappeared.
Wow.
And nobody could find out where he went for 6 months. And then he turns up living out of a homeless shelter in Key West, Florida. So he got as far from Bay Village as he could possibly get without leaving the United States.
You've got to share the story. I saw the story about you pursuing him down to Key West and how you found him. Can you give us the short version of that?
Sure, yeah. So I learned about this suspect in 2008 when a number of his students contacted me, and I was a reporter at Scene at the time. And I just needed to talk to this guy and see him for myself. And in my mind, I had never been to Key West, but I had been to like Kelly's Island, and I knew Kelly's Island was pretty small. So I figured, well, Key West is probably not much bigger. So I bet I could find him if I went down there. If you've ever been to Key West, of course, when I got down there, it is huge. It's a huge island. And it's like searching for a needle in the haystack. I had about 48 hours where I could look for him. I showed his picture around. I had a flyer I'd printed out, and I was showing his picture around town. Especially, you know, there's like a main road where a lot of bars are. And people were telling me, yeah, that's the guy that plays ragtime piano at the bars sometimes. And I knew that was him because he played ragtime piano at Disneyland and Cedar Point in the summer. So I knew I was getting close, but I still couldn't find him. Finally, I went to the homeless shelter where he had been when he first moved to the island years ago. I asked around there, and finally I found this guy, and he said, if anybody knows where he is, it's got to be Mr. Frisbee. And I said, really? Who's Mr. Frisbee? And he points at the beach, and there's this guy on the beach that's throwing a frisbee to himself. Like, he'll throw it really hard, and then he'll go running after it, and he'll catch it. And so that's Mr. Frisbee. So I went up to Mr. Frisbee, and I showed him the picture, and he said, oh, yeah, that's my friend. I know where he is. He's probably at work right now. I said, oh, yeah, where's that? And he said, well, he manages the Wendy's on the island. So I then went to Wendy's, and sure enough, he is the manager, or was the manager there. But he had called off work that day. And so I came up with the story. I said, hey, I'm a former student of this man, and I came all the way out here. I'd love to catch up with him. Do you have a phone number or address for him? And the woman went into the employee records, and she came back, and she's like, this is strange. He didn't list any address or phone number on his application. And she's like, I'm sorry, I don't know where he is or how to reach him. So I drove around, and it got to the point where I needed to drive back to Miami to catch my flight back home. I had like 45 minutes left, and I stopped at a stop sign on the northeast side of the island, or quarter of the island. I hadn't prayed in a number of years, and you could call it a prayer or a message to the universe or whatever, but I just in my head I sent out this message, and I said, if this is the guy, I need help because I can't find him. And at that exact moment, he walked in front of my car.
It's crazy.
And, It is one of the craziest things that's ever happened to me. And so I pull off on the side of the road, and I get out and I yell out, hey, you know, his name. And he stops and turns, and I walk over to him. And at the corner of this road, we had this conversation. And I said, do you know who I am? And he right away says, yeah, you're James Renner. My sister told me you'd probably be coming to look for me. You know, we talked about the Nature Center, and I decided to bluff him, because it all comes down to whether or not he was at that Nature Center. And his students tell me he was, but he told the police, well, at least the police and the FBI told me when they interviewed him, when they interrogated him, he said he was never there. So I decided to bluff him, and I said, what would you tell me if I told you that I have a picture of you and one of your students at that Nature Center, that one of your students showed me this picture? And he got real quiet, and he thought for just a second, and then he said, and I quote, I never told the FBI I wasn't there. All I ever said was, I don't remember being there. So he is lying about being at that Nature Center, and in my mind, I can only think of one reason why he would want to lie about that, because he knows it's important.
Wow. Well, that's an incredible twist of fate. I would like to believe the universe was answering your call for help there when they put him in
I'd
your
like
path.
I'd like to believe, too. I mean, how cruel would it be, though, if he proves out, if we learn that he wasn't the guy that did it? You know, what does that say? Yeah, so whatever it says, it's a strange story.
Now, I understand the police have revealed some pretty stunning evidence that they have not shared before. So why don't you tell our listeners what the latest news is on this evidence and what you think it means?
So there's been a couple new details that have come out in the last couple of years. One big one was that they released pictures of an avocado green curtain that had been used to wrap Amy's body when her body was placed in the field in Ashland County. It's a very specific type of curtain, a weird narrow size. So if you get a chance, go online and look for these pictures. I have them up on my website, but somebody will recognize, the hope is that somebody recognizes this curtain, even though they didn't release news about this for like 25 years. But it's a handmade curtain. It looks like it was made from a bedspread that somebody then turned into a curtain. So very specific little detail. And then just lately, we learned a lot more about the DNA evidence that they have in this case. Just like everything else in the case, it's promising but also very frustrating. They found three hairs on Amy's body, one hair on her body, one hair on her jogging pants, one hair on her underwear. And each of these hairs comes from a different person. And that can mean a number of things. That could mean we're dealing with contact DNA transfer, which means her body was placed in a car, and let's say the killer a couple weeks before that had driven his cousin or nephew or an aunt, and they had ridden in the car, and one of their hairs ended up on the seat, and then when Amy was placed there, that hair ended up on her body.
Okay.
So that's one way that explains why there's numerous people's DNA on her. The other explanation, of course, is that we're dealing with more than one man, that more than one man was involved in the abduction and murder of Amy Mihaljevic, which is an idea that, you know, I've come to consider more and more over the years. One of the reasons being there's so many likely suspects, maybe a couple of them did it together. It's not like CSI. You know, they don't have a full strand of this person's DNA. It's degraded, and it's mitochondrial DNA, which means what you want is nuclear DNA, which is everything. Mitochondrial DNA is kind of like DNA that's passed from the mother to the child, and it's very fractured. So, you know, you think of DNA as like a ladder with 1,000 rungs. Well, what they have in Amy Mahalik's case with one of these hairs is they have five rungs. So it's enough to hold up against somebody else's genetic profile, and if they don't have those five rungs in that order, you can rule them out as that's not their hair. But it's not enough to say definitively, yes, that hair was left by this person. It only lets you rule out people.
You know, I can understand why they might have held back on something like the hair evidence, but in terms of the police holding back on that unique, one-of-a-kind, homemade curtain, and the fact that those girls in North Olmsted had been called by the same killer, that seems to me the kind of evidence that the public might be helpful on, that there might be somebody out there who could shed light in both of those cases. And yet we didn't know about any of that stuff for, what, more than a decade. And well, what do you make of that?
I think it's a couple things. One, I think you're dealing with a very conservative police department, so they want to be very careful about what they release, because one of the reasons you hold back that information is when people come and confess to it. You have to be sure that their confession is accurate. But I also think that part of it was dealing with an FBI. The FBI was such a major presence in this case. And they, especially in Cleveland, and the specific agents that were involved in this case, they have a distrust of the media, and they have a way of looking and thinking of reporters as, you know, troublemakers, as, you know, we're just kind of getting in the way. And there's little respect there between the FBI and the press. And I think that was a big part of it. And they had all this info, and they just thought, well, it's not going to do us any good to share these with reporters. They'll just mess it up.
Well, we've got to send our listeners to your blog. You've had a blog for several years on Amy's case. It's on it's amymahalovic.blogspot.com, and that's a mouthful. So we'll put it on our website, Ohio Mystery, so people can just click on it and go straight there. And I know you keep people updated on a lot of things that come to you, not through the police. People are contacting you now with information. I got to ask you, I saw the one thing, I think it was back in November, somebody had called you from a rental property in Wayne County who found an old and worn carving on a closet door that said A.M. was murdered here. What did you make of that?
Yeah, that's a really weird clue. I can tell you that the police followed up on it immediately. They went out there and spoke to the guy that owned the place, and I think they're looking into who was living at that property at the time. I don't think it's going to end up being connected to the case at all. If that's the, you know, I could see like a teen kid, you know, doing that, you know, for whatever reason. But I don't think it was any sort of confession. But it's certainly scary, you know, and who else could they be talking about?
And it could have been, I mean, that was huge news. It certainly would have been news in Wayne County. And even if the carving was old, somebody certainly could have done it, you know, back then, just hearing the news. But it really struck me because Wayne County is getting pretty close to Ashland County. And I know the police kind of thought maybe the killer knew the Ashland County area because of where her body was found. And I thought, well, Wayne County, you're getting pretty close.
Yep, it is pretty close. And for sure, the killer had to know County Road 1181, where her body was found. It's the perfect place to do that, to leave a body. At night, you know, even today, that area where her body was found, you can't really see any other houses. So nobody can see what you're doing, and if it's at night, you'll see headlights coming for like a mile, or you know, before they reach you. So you've got plenty of time to get out of there before you're spotted.
James, are they going to solve this case?
Yeah, it's going to be solved. The question is whether or not it's going to be solved before the person who committed the crime is dead. And you know, so they still have these hairs, and eventually they can retest them, but they only get one more chance. So they're being very careful about waiting for the perfect time to do that. I hope they just, I'd rather they just roll the dice and see what they can get from a new test. But there's enough DNA evidence that, you know, using the familial DNA technique, when they eventually retest, or even with what they have now, it might be enough to point to somebody. You know, maybe even if it's like the second cousin of whoever left a hair in that car. If you manage to track that person down, you know, would they have written in the car of one of these top three suspects? I mean, that'll get you darn close to your answer. So, I think it'll be solved. I think probably within the next 5 to 10 years. But, you know, my main suspect is not getting any younger. And, you know, you'd at least hope that he'd be able to be in prison for the amount of time he's remained free since Amy's murder. And I don't think that's possible anymore.
Right. James, is there anything we haven't brought up that you want to talk about?
No, there's a lot of attention on this case right now and a lot of new tips. I'm very optimistic. I'm always surprised by this case. I went to the FBI and police with a couple unique tips just in the last 2 weeks. And just because I have a suspect who looks pretty good for this doesn't mean I'm never 100% sure. You know, for that reason, a couple of these tips that I passed on involve totally new suspects. They're, you know, there are two new guys that are at least possible. So I know the police are looking into those leads. One is an alleged confession, which, you know, when you get those are always promising, but does it match up? Then the biggest tip that's come out since this ID discovery series, which if anybody hasn't watched that yet, it's really worth the watch. They did a great job.
And the name of that series is the Lake Erie,
The Lake Erie Murders. Amy Mihaljevic's case is the first three episodes of that series. So it's 3 hours long. They do a great job of that. And that got a lot of attention when it came out. A lot of people contacted me. And one of the things that came out of there was a former student of my main suspect who, remember, he says he was never at that nature center or that he doesn't remember being there. And that's the key, is putting him there. Well, one of his students came forward, and he's a great witness. He's got, you know, he's sane. He's got a great job. He has no reason to lie. And he says that he was one of this teacher's personal helpers for 2 years. And he says, not only do I know that he was at that nature center, I went to the nature center with him to deliver the mice for the snakes. And I did it on multiple occasions. So now we can definitively link him to the nature center, which is big. So lots of new stuff. You know, how active the police and FBI are, I don't know. But I do know that they're you follow up on all that stuff.
Well, let's hope this all leads to the right conviction. Obviously, there are more than one suspects, but we definitely want the correct one caught. Steve?
Of course.
I've already expressed off mic what a huge fan I am. You were by far my favorite true crime author. The one thing I'd like to communicate to our audience is that James Renner gets very involved in the cases he covers. He spends his own money. I heard you once say that. You get a glimpse of that by watching The Disappearance of Murrah Murray, a television documentary of sorts, a case covered in your book, True Crime Addict. I have to ask the question as a fan, even though I probably know the answer. Tina Harmon, you know, serial killer's apprentice, that's my personal favorite, by the way. Amy Mihaljevic, Murrah Murray, you know, Tina Harmon, Robert Buell was charged with that, but there's some discrepancy there, maybe. In your lifetime, which one do you want to see the most solved?
Amy, for sure, no doubt about it. I kind of knew.
I knew it was going to be Amy, but I had to ask the question.
Yeah, you know, just because I've spent, you know, so many years just thinking about it and wondering it, and it would be nice to have the answer there. And you know, there's never closure in any case like this. You know, in real life, that's not a real thing. I asked Amy's dad once about closure, and he said, "Closure's for doors, not people." you know, so, but he wants answers, you know, and it would be nice for them to know what happened and who did it.
Absolutely. James, thank you so much for being here with us. You know that serial killer's apprentice would qualify as an Ohio mystery because it's still a mystery.
Yeah.
So we might have to have you back later this year for another episode.
For sure.
Awesome.
That'd be great.
James, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for another Ohio Mysteries. You can find photos, news clippings, and links at our website, ohiomysteries.com. For this and all of our episodes, check it out.
That brings us to tonight's featured musical artist. At the start of this podcast, you heard a snip of No New Wilderness, written and performed by folk singer-songwriter Drew Joseph, based out of Toledo. You'll find Drew all over social media, including Facebook and Twitter, or just go straight to his website. It's named for his debut album and also the song we played for you, nonewwilderness.com. Drew tells me on every song on that album, he's placed a biblical reference, and he loves hearing from fans who have found them all. So if you like a challenge, go to his website, play the songs, figure out the puzzle, and shoot him an email. I'd love to hear from you. Anyway, Drew performs all the time, so check out his Facebook page, hit the events button, and look for the next show.
And you can find links to Drew Joseph and all of our featured musical artists under the featured music link on our website at ohiomysteries.com. But do that later. Right now, turn up the volume, close your eyes, and enjoy the full version of No New Wilderness. And we'll see you back here next week for another Ohio Mystery.
Cannot hold your tongue when you know something's wrong. Your words fall out like rain, and I see everything. Every pale excuse for what they've done to you. Each sacred promise kept, each one that time forgets. Flocks gather across the land, taking refuge in your hand. New life your mother made in her great labor pains. But when your time has come, beneath the obvious sun, there is no sympathy, no quiet place to sleep. Yellow dawn, purple dust, unbroken silent trust that flow east. Fountain head, unravel every thread. Four winds begin to blow, bring up what lies below. Swallow the wicked fruit, choke out the wretched root. Blossom rests. There's no new wilderness, no seed beneath the soil. The rifle stock records, but you don't ask me for a whitewashed killing floor, a stroke to clean the slate. Some things you can't. Stomach reminders like, was this my fault or yours?
The Battle of Waterloo was one of the most famous turning points in world history. But what happened next? My name's David Montgomery, and I'm the host of The Siecle, a history podcast that tackles exactly that. Join me as I cover France's overlooked century in between Napoleon and World War I. The Siecle, spelled S-I-E-C-L-E, is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and can be found wherever you get podcasts.